This is number four. Catherine Bartle and David Martin, in their book entitled Management, remind us that knowledge about management today is the result of a long and continuing innovative process. Perhaps it would be well at this point in our discussion to take somewhat of an overall look at what some have called the evolution of management theories, and consider the various contributions of several pre-classical contributors. We've given in the first three somewhat of an introduction to management and somewhat of an introduction to management study, and some basic foundational concepts and truths about one who would serve as an administrator, manager in a position of leadership within an organization or a local church. But how have we arrived at these understandings of management? What has brought us to this position? Here we are discussing the evolution of various management theories. Although examples of management practice go back several thousand years, we understand that the development of management as a field of knowledge and a field of study and a discipline of study, perhaps on the college or graduate level, is a much more recent occurrence. Much of the impetus for developing management theories and principles stemmed from what we know in history as the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution, of course, spawned the growth of factories and industries during the early 1800s. We find that with the proliferation of factories came also the widespread need to coordinate the efforts of large numbers of people in the continual production of the goods that these factories were producing. This challenge brought forth a number of individuals who began to think about innovative ways to run factories more effectively. This group, known as pre-classical contributors to management, focused largely on particular techniques that might be applied to solve specific problems. They were followed by individuals who began to develop broader principles and theories that became the basis of major viewpoints or schools of management, such as the classical school, the behavioral school, the quantitative school, and the contemporary school. Several approaches have contributed to the development of each of these various viewpoints. It would perhaps be well for us to spend a few moments by way of introduction to this evolution or the pioneering ideas in management. We think of the pre-classical contributors. A number of individuals in the pre-classical period of the middle and late 1800s offered ideas that laid the groundwork for subsequent broader inquiries into the nature of management. Probably we could mention some of the principal pre-classical contributors, such as Robert Owen, Charles Babbage, and Henry P. Towne. Let's think of Robert Owen for a moment. A successful British entrepreneur, Robert Owen, whose dates are 1771 to 1858, was well ahead of his time in recognizing the importance of human resources. He became particularly interested in the working and living conditions of his employees while running a small cotton mill in New Lanark, Scotland. As was common, the mill employed 400 to 500 young children who worked 13 hours a day, and that included 1.5 hours off for meals. Although his business partners resisted some of his ideas, Owen tried to improve the living conditions of the employees by upgrading streets, houses, sanitation, and the education system in his town. At the time, Owen was considered to be a radical, but of course today his views are widely accepted. His ideas laid the groundwork for the human relations movement, which of course would be discussed later. And then another pre-classical contributor was Charles Babbage. English mathematician Charles Babbage, his dates are 1792 to 1871, is widely known as the father of modern computing. His projects produced the world's first practical mechanical calculator and an analytical engine that had the basic elements of a modern-day computer. Difficulties in directing his various projects, however, led him to explore new ways of doing things. In the process, he made direct contributions to management theory. Babbage was enthralled with the idea of work specialization, the degree to which work is divided into various jobs. He recognized that not only physical work, but also mental work as well could be specialized. In this sense, he foresaw the prospect of specialists, such as accountants, who would limit their practice to either personal or corporate taxes. Babbage also devised a profit-sharing plan that had two parts: a bonus that was awarded for useful suggestions, and a portion of wages that was dependent upon factory profits. His ideas foreshadowed some modern-day group incentive plans, which are still in effect in certain organizations today. And then another pre-classical contributor, not only Robert Owen, not only Charles Babbage, but Henry R. Towne. President of Yale and Towne Manufacturing Company and a mechanical engineer, Henry R. Towne, his dates 1844 to 1924, articulated the need to consider management as a separate field of systematic inquiry on an equal par with engineering. He outlined his views in a landmark paper which he entitled The Engineer and Economist. This was delivered in 1886 to the American Society of Mechanical Engineers in Chicago. He observed that although good engineering skills and good business skills were rarely combined in the same individual, both skills were needed to run an organization effectively. Accordingly, the paper called for the establishment of a science of management and the development of principles that could be applied across managerial situations. Although the Engineering Society itself did not become a major force in developing knowledge about management, one of the people who attended Towne's presentation, Frederick Taylor, was subsequently instrumental in building and adding to the theory of management. Although the early pioneers explored several different avenues relating to management, their efforts were somewhat fragmented. They were largely oriented toward developing specific techniques, often to solve visible problems. For example, to overcome chaotic meetings, Henry Robert produced Robert's Rules of Order, a publication of the pre-classical era that is still used today to run large formal meetings. When we think about the classical viewpoint, perhaps we could say this: Henry Towne's call for establishing management as a separate field of inquiry helped usher in a major new approach called the classical viewpoint. The classical viewpoint is a perspective on management that emphasizes finding ways to manage work and organizations more efficiently. It's made up of three different approaches. First, there is scientific management. Second, there is administrative management. And thirdly, there is bureaucratic management. This viewpoint, labeled classical because it encompasses early works and related contributions that have formed the main roots of the field of management study. In regard to classical viewpoint, we would consider, first of all, scientific management. Scientific management is an approach within classical management theory that emphasizes the scientific study of work methods in order to improve worker efficiency. There were certain major representatives and contributors in this field. They would include Frederick Winslow Taylor, Frank and Lillian Gilbreth, and Henry Gant. First, we look at Frederick Winslow Taylor. Frederick Winslow Taylor, whose dates are 1856 to 1915, is known as the father of scientific management. Born into a relatively wealthy Philadelphia family, Taylor became an apprenticed pattern maker and mechanist for a local firm before moving on to Midvale Steel. At Midvale, his his rise from laborer to chief engineer in 6 years gave him opportunity to tackle a serious problem that he had observed, and that was the soldering by workers. Soldering is deliberately working at less than full capacity. Taylor believed that workers engaged in this practice for three main reasons. First, they feared that increasing their productivity would cause them or other workers to lose their jobs. Second, faulty wages systems set up by management encouraged workers to operate at a slow pace. For example, some companies cut incentive pay when workers began to exceed standards, thus making workers reluctant to succeed. And third, general methods of working and rules of thumb handed down from generation to generation were often very inefficient. Taylor believed that managers could resolve this problem by developing a science of management based on four specific principles. Central to the approach was the concept of using scientific means to determine how tasks could be done rather than relying on past experience of each individual worker. Specifically, Taylor pioneered a method known as the time and motion study. Taylor called it a time study. This type of study involves breaking down the work into its various elements or motions, eliminating unnecessary motions, determining the best way to do the job, and then timing each motion to determine the amount of production that could be expected per day. In order to solve the problem of the wage system that encouraged the slowing down of work, Taylor advocated the use of wage incentive plans. He argued that workers should be paid from 30 to 100% higher wages for using the scientifically developed work methods and for attaining or exceeding daily standards. A famous study by Taylor at Bethlehem Steel focused on this concept. Until Taylor introduced scientific management, workers typically brought their own tools to the job. Taylor noted that a worker might use the same shovel for both iron ore and ashes, even though the relative weights of the material were very different. On the basis of his studies, Taylor determined that the optimum weight for shoveling was 21 pounds. Therefore, he argued that it made sense to have shovels of different sizes for different classes of materials so that the weight of what was being shoveled would be about 21 pounds. Results of implementing his plan with company-owned shovels demonstrated that the average number of tons shoveled per worker per day increased from 16 to 59. At the same time, the average earnings per worker per day increased from $1.15 to $1.88, and the average cost of handling a long ton, that's 2,240 pounds, decreased from 0.072 cents to 0.033 cents. Taylor's plan included additional incentive pay for workers and was beneficial for the company. Taylor ran into opposition from some members of management, citizens of Bethlehem, and others who argued that he was exploiting workers by getting them to produce more and causing large reductions in the workforce at Bethlehem Steel. A strike at the Watertown, Massachusetts Army Arsenal from 1911 to 1912, where some of Taylor's ideas were being tested, led to a congressional investigation. The results of the investigation concluded there was not any concrete evidence that workers were being abused in any way by Taylorism. Since the negative publicity showed the momentum of scientific management to some degree, nevertheless, by the end of World War I, scientific management, aided by several French management experts, was spreading across Europe and was being used in such diverse places as English chocolate factories, Icelandic fisheries, German paper mills, and Swedish typewriter factories. There's little doubt that the innovative ideas that Taylor popularized remain in use today. His four basic principles Taylor's four basic principles of scientific management could be perhaps summarized in this way. Number one, scientifically study each part of a task and develop the best method for performing the task. Number two, carefully select workers and train them to perform the task by using the scientifically developed method. Number three, Coordinate fully with workers to ensure that they use the proper method. And number four, divide work and responsibility so that management is responsible for planning work methods using scientific principles and workers are responsible for executing the work accordingly. So again, the work of Frederick Winslow Taylor had certainly great impact as he placed into position the idea of scientific management. We think now about the Gilberts. Other major advocates of scientific management were the husband and wife team of Frank and Lilith Gilbert. Their dates from approximately the late 1800s into the 1900s. Although Frank had qualified for admission to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, he decided to become a bricklayer because of the importance of that profession at the time. As Frank became involved in training young bricklayers, he noticed the inefficiencies that were handed down from experienced workers. To remedy the situation, he proposed using motion studies to streamline the bricklaying process. Frank also designed special scaffolding for different types of jobs, and he devised precise directions for mortar consistency. On the basis of these and other ideas, Frank was able to reduce the motions involved in bricklaying from 18.5 to 4. Using his approach, workers increased the number of bricks laid per day from 1,000 to 2,700 with no increase in physical exertion. Meanwhile, Frank married Lillian Moeller, who began working with him on projects while she completed her doctorate in psychology. The two continued their studies aimed at eliminating unnecessary motions and expanded their interest in exploring ways to reduce task fatigue. Part of their work involved in the isolation of 7 basic motions has become a classic in management theory. This concept of the 17 basic motions included such motions as select, position, and hold. Motions that the Gilberts used to study tasks in a number of industries. The Gilberts also pioneered the use of motion picture technology in the study of jobs. Again, part of their work involved the isolation of 17 basic motions. Lillian's doctoral thesis, published as the book The Psychology of Management, was one of the early works applying the findings of psychology to the workplace. At the insistence of the publisher, the author was listed as L. M. Gilbert to disguise the fact that the book was written by a woman. Lillian helped define scientific management by arguing that scientific studies of management must focus on both analysis and synthesis. With analysis, a task is broken down into its essential parts or its essential elements. With synthesis, the task is reconstructed to include only those elements necessary for efficient work. She also had a particular interest in the human implications of scientific management, arguing that the purpose of scientific management is to help people reach their maximum potential by developing their skills and abilities. In 1924, Frank died suddenly of a heart attack, leaving Lillian with their 12 children ranging in age from 2 to 19. She then continued the couple's innovative study and consulting work, finally becoming a professor of management at Purdue University. Lillian Gilbert ranks as the first woman to gain prominence as a major contributor to the development of management as a science. Then another individual that we might mention in this classical period, we, of course, have talked about Frederick Winslow Taylor. We've talked about the Gilberts, Frank and Lillian. And another name that certainly comes to the forefront is the name of Henry L. Gantt, G-A-N-T-T. One of Taylor's closest associates was Henry Gantt. His dates are 1861 to 1919. Henry Gantt worked with Taylor in several companies, including Midvale Steel and Bethlehem Steel. Gantt later became an independent consultant and made several contributions of his own. The most well-known is the Gantt chart. a graphic aid to planning, scheduling, and control that is still in use today. He also devised a unique pay incentive system that not only paid workers extra for reaching standards in the allotted time, but also awarded bonuses to supervisors when workers reached those standards. Thus, the system encouraged supervisors to coach those workers who were having difficulty. Well, these are some of the important names within this particular classical viewpoint: Frederick Winslow Taylor, the Gilbreths, and Henry L. Gantt. Now we want to take a few moments and look at what has been identified as bureaucratic management. Another branch of the classical viewpoint is bureaucratic management, an approach that emphasizes the need for organizations to operate in a rational manner rather than relying on arbitrary whims of owners and managers. The bureaucratic management approach is based mainly on the work of the prominent German sociologist Max Weber. Weber, whose dates are 1864 to 1920, was born into an affluent family with strong political and social concerns. He pursued a career as a consultant, a professor, and eventually an author. Because he was so well-read, he was able to make contributions that span a number of academic disciplines, such as management, sociology, economics, and philosophy. Among his most important contributions to the discipline of management are his ideas on the need for organizations to operate on a more rational basis. In formulating his ideas, Weber was reacting to the prevailing norms of class consciousness and nepotism. For example, it was customary practice to allow only individuals of aristocratic birth to become officers in the Prussian army or to attain high-level positions in government and industry. Weber felt that this situation was not only unfair, but also led to a significant waste of human resources. He also believed that running organizations on the basis of the position that one held, rather than what one knows, and engaging in nepotism, that is the hiring of relatives regardless of their competence, tended to interfere with organizational effectiveness. In an effort to visualize how the large organizations evolving out of the Industrial Revolution might ideally operate, Weber formulated characteristics of the ideal bureaucracy. He coined the term bureaucracy to identify large organizations that operated on a rational basis. Weber understood clearly that in his ideal bureaucracy, it did not actually exist. In fact, he never intended that his ideas be used as guidelines for managers. Rather, his purpose was to develop ideas that could be used as a starting point in understanding such organizations. However, when his work was translated into English in the late 1940s, many U.S. management scholars used his ideas as guides to how organizations could be more effectively managed. Because of the possibility of carrying Weber's ideas to excess, the term bureaucracy is sometimes used in a negative sense to denote red tape and excessive rules. Yet there clearly are advantages to the bureaucratic characteristics outlined by Weber. For example, there were recent troubles at the family-owned U-Haul Corporation. These can be traced to confusion over roles and secret meetings of the board of directors, hidden rule changes, and advancement determined by family ties. And all of these were violations of Weber's ideas. The resulting feuds in the U-Haul situation and the court battles among family members are seriously threatening the viability of the national renter of trucks, trailers, and other equipment. But what are these major characteristics of Weber's ideal bureaucracy? Well, let's just mention these. One of the first characteristics is what he identified as the specialization of labor. By this, he meant that jobs are broken down into routine, well-defined tasks so that members know what is expected of them and can become extremely competent at their particular set of tasks. Then, not only is there the specialization of labor, but number two, formal rules and procedures are established. Written rules and procedures specify the behaviors desired from members to facilitate coordination and to ensure uniformity within the organization. So, Weber stated there should be a specialization of labor, that formal rules and procedures should be established. He also discussed the idea of impersonality. Rules, procedures, and sanctions are applied uniformly, regardless of individual personalities and personal considerations. And then he said that there should be a well-defined hierarchy. Multiple levels of positions with carefully determined reporting relationships among these levels provide supervision of lower levels by higher ones, a means of handling exceptions, and the ability to establish accountability of actions. So he said there should be a well-defined hierarchy. And then one of the last characteristics of Weber's ideal bureaucracy was that career advancement should be based on merit. The selection and promotion is based on the qualifications and the performance of individuals. So these are the major characteristics of Weber's ideal bureaucracy. Number one, a specialization of labor. Number two, formal rules and procedures. Number three, impersonality. Number four, well-defined hierarchy. And number five, career advancement should be based upon merit. Another area within this particular time period of classical management study. That not only during this period do we find scientific management, not only during this period do we find bureaucratic management, but there's also administrative management. While the advocates of scientific management concentrated on developing principles that could be used to help organize individual worker tasks more effectively, and Weber struggled with the concept of bureaucracy, another branch within the classical viewpoint was also developing. The administrative management approach focuses on principles that can be used by managers to coordinate the internal activities of the organization. Certain major contributors to this administrative management would include certain individuals as Henry Fayol, F-A-Y-O-L, and Chester Bernard. Henry Fayol and Chester Bernard.